The runaway bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, is reissued in the wake of the post-truth era.
Look, you have a right to your own opinion, but you don't have a right to your own fact. You have to use facts that you can show, then that we can all agree on. And once you do that, and you show why this, and this is a key question to ask students when they cite a website, or when they cite, for that matter, a really allegedly good work of history, and that is, why is this source credible?
That's James E. Loewen. We talk with him about his bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and why teaching history the right way is so important to our democracy. Then, the celebrated author of The Giver is writing a play about school shootings
that grapples with the question of gun violence and who might be the person who will ultimately, down the road, not on the stage, pick up a gun and aim it at innocent people. And so it presents a cast of young people, any one of whom might be that person. And the audience then becomes a kind of participant, because the audience has to guess from the information given who that will be.
We speak with Lois Lowry about her work in progress, currently titled Fun and Games. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. American public school students may have James Loewen to thank for their access to works of critical thinking about U.S. history. That's not only because of his huge bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, published in 1995. It's also because he won a landmark suit against Mississippi when the state tried to ban the use of his first book, an award-winning history of Mississippi that didn't shrink to describe its racist past. That suit led to his writing Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Now he's just published an updated version of Lies My Teacher Told Me with a new preface that shows how bad history courses in high school help produce adults who think Donald Trump can solve their problems. James Loewen is a sociologist who taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont. Previously, he taught at predominantly black Tougaloo College in Mississippi. In addition to Lies My Teacher Told Me, he's the author of Sundown Towns and Mississippi, Conflict and Change, among other books. Well, James W. Loewen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hey, I'm glad to be on it.
Now, I was just thrilled at the opportunity to talk to you about your best-selling book, which you've now reissued, Lies My Teacher Told Me. You say that as far as you can tell, that Lies My Teacher Told Me is the best-selling book by a living sociologist, which is amazing in itself. But that caught my eye because you're not a historian.
That's right. I am a sociologist. I got so interested in, well, first of all, of course, the world does not come divided up into disciplines, you know. I mean, I wrote my very first book, my doctoral dissertation, was, well, it's called The Mississippi Chinese Between Black and White. It's actually still in print after all these years. And it covers the story of this racial minority in the Mississippi Delta that started there in about 1868 and is still there, although they've been leaving rapidly from about 1968 until now. And I wrote the original edition in 1968. Well, is that a work of history or is that a work of sociology? Of course, the answer has to be yes, right? But what really got me so interested in history was my first full-time teaching job, which was at Tougaloo College. Now, that is T-O-U-G-A-L-O-O. There will be a quiz later. It's a small college. It's a black college, and it's in far-off Mississippi. So I know a lot of your listeners will not have heard of it. But it's a very good college, and I taught there for 7 years. And my first year of teaching there, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology. And I was also pressed into service to teach one section of what was called the Freshman Social Science. What was it called? Freshman Social Science Seminar. That's what it was. Well, the Freshman Social Science Seminar introduced students to all of the social sciences, anthropology, sociology, psych, econ, poli-sci. It did this in the context of African-American history, and in fact, the course had been invented by the history department. Now, when you're in that context, that's, of course, the same chronology as, shall we say, regular American history, and so second semester begins not only after Christmas, but it also begins after the Civil War with the period known as Reconstruction. So that first day of class, second semester, I had a new group of students, 17 of them. I didn't want to do all the talking. So I asked them, what was Reconstruction? What happened then? And what happened to me might be called an aha moment, although it might better be called an oh no moment, because 16 out of my 17 students replied that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again.
Wow.
Exactly. I mean, I tell that to audiences, and I hope they make a reaction, because there's at least three direct lies in that sentence. Black folks never took over the government of the southern states. They all had white governors throughout the period. All but one had a white legislative majority. Second of all, the Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they passed the best state constitutions that the southern states have ever had, much better than the ones they labor under today. Mississippi, in particular, had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century, so they did not screw up. We can go further with this. I mean, the concept too soon out of slavery, that is something to think about, since slavery did not even allow even free blacks to learn how to read and write. That was a felony to teach them. So anyway, I was astounded at this, and I tried to find out how it happened. So I visited nearby schools, and this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South. So I visited nearby black schools. And there I watched as black teachers taught all black classes, white supremacist, we call it BS, we in sociology, that stands for bad sociology, because they were just teaching what was in the book, particularly in the course Mississippi History, which was aimed at fifth graders and then again at ninth graders. So what to do? I tried to get my history teaching friends to write a new textbook for that course, but they were busy. And so eventually I got a grant, and I collected some students and faculty at Tougaloo and also at Millsaps College, the nearby white school, and we wrote a new history, Mississippi Conflict and Change. It won an award for the best nonfiction book of the entire South for that year, but the state of Mississippi rejected it for public school use, so we had to sue them. And the result, which is called Lowen et al. Versus Turnip Seed et al., the result is actually one of the nine, I think, lawsuits that the American Library Association posts on their website as critical to our freedom to read in this country. So we won. Mm. But that result also showed me, the whole escapade showed me, that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had been used against my students.
Yeah.
So that's what got me so interested in history. And then I moved to the University of Vermont. I sometimes claim I taught at the blackest and the whitest schools in America. And I continued to teach first-year students, now in huge classes in intro soc. And they continued to amaze me, because they give you a window on the world of high school, because they didn't know some of the most important things in the past that ever had happened, and they did know some terribly important things that had not happened. And I came to realize that really bad history in high school was not a Mississippi phenomenon. It was a national phenomenon. Mississippi just represented this national problem in a more exaggerated form, as Mississippi represented a lot of problems in a more exaggerated form in that era.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Loewen about his newly reissued bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me. Yeah, so you write that 5/6 of all Americans never take a course in American history beyond high school.
Yep.
I was a history major in college, and I remember the moment I decided to be a history major in college. It was when I was in high school. I was turned on to the study of history by reading the essay by Henry Steele Commager, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution.
How did you come to read that in high school?
I actually went to a private school, and I had a terrific high school history teacher.
Yeah.
It gave me a glimpse of the real motivators behind events, some real motivations behind events, and cut through the kind of hagiography that we usually are subjected to when it comes to the founding fathers. Why have textbooks so typically lied to their students about American history?
Well, there's a number of reasons we could give. I mean, I've already implicated the state of Mississippi. And, of course, Mississippi adopts statewide. Texas adopts statewide. Half of all states adopt statewide. And publishers don't want to offend Mississippi. They sure don't want to offend Texas. They don't want to lose sales. So they are very timid. I give the example of the... Well, he's not notorious. He should be. The notorious president, Franklin W. Pierce, who is my candidate for the second worst president of all time. For one thing, he was so bad that he's the only president who won an election and then his own party denied him renomination, even though he wanted to be renominated. He was so bad that when he left the presidency and went home to New Hampshire at the end, nobody met his train. He was so bad that during the Civil War, when he actually openly sided with the South, he had to move out of the country briefly. So he was a really unpopular and terrible president in many ways. Okay, well, but now he's the only president that New Hampshire ever produced. So he gets a totally bland and totally incorrect laudatory historical marker right outside the state capitol. And the publishers don't want to lose sales in New Hampshire. And so they don't say anything, like I just said. They are completely bland about what they say about Franklin W. Pierce. Well, if you can't offend anybody about anything, then you are going to write a truly boring and bland textbook and truly inaccurate.
Yeah, you also say that there are three topics that are absolutely taboo in textbooks. Sex,
religion, and social class.
There we go. And the one I wanted to zero in on is social class.
Yes. Well, isn't that amazing? Well, it is amazing to me that it's taboo, because it's one of the most important variables. I would argue, actually, it's the most important single variable in sociology. We sociologists know that there are good studies that show social class predicts whether or not you've ever hired a lawyer, whether or not you've ever hired a good lawyer, whether or not you were a Boy Scout, whether you were an Episcopal or a Baptist, you know, et cetera. Social class is a terribly important variable. How can we leave it out? But we do. If you look it up in the index, social class, social stratification, middle class, upper class, lower class, anything, you don't find these terms. And it's not a matter of bad indexing either. The only thing you find is a few statements like this. Unlike the rigid class system in Great Britain or in Europe, the United States was more fluid, had kind of a middle class system. Well, it turns out that's not true. Unfortunately, I wish it were true. But measures of social class show that we actually have more stratification than any other industrialized nation, and we have had since about 1915. And we all know this these days. I mean, we're talking about the 1% and all the issues about Wall Street and stuff under the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration. So everybody knows that social class is important. So everybody in school knows that if you don't talk about social class, something is going wrong, and something is going wrong.
And now you also tackle not only the misinformation, let's say, but also the approaches of textbooks, of high school textbooks in particular. For example, you say that authors almost never use the present to illuminate the past, and the converse is also true. They don't use the past to illuminate the present.
Yeah.
This seems to be an incredible blind spot, especially because to me, the study of history is the purpose of it is precisely to understand the present.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the way they teach it is not relevant. Now, why would that be? Well, because if you try to make, let's say, the Civil War relevant and Reconstruction relevant to the present, well, then you're being controversial, because the present is controversial. I mean, let's look at the Civil War and Reconstruction. First of all, the South, the Southern states, seceded because they were against states' rights. And between 1890 and 1940, they managed to flip this narrative. And now a lot of people think that they seceded for states' rights. But they actually, when they left, they listed the states that upset them. They listed the rights that these states were trying to claim that upset them. And they made quite clear that they were seceding for slavery and against states' rights. Well, if you say that today, you're going to upset the neo-Confederate parents. And there's plenty of neo-Confederate parents in the North. It's not just a Southern phenomenon. So you don't want to make that clear. And so neither the textbooks are clear, and oftentimes teachers are not clear about that. Then, if you look at Reconstruction, the key problem with Reconstruction, unlike what my students thought it was, is that it ended, and it was ended, by KKK violence and by fraud and by the white racist Democrats, because back in those days, the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy, open white supremacy. This is flipped, unfortunately. We shouldn't have either party connected, openly for white supremacy. So the issue again would then tie into race relations today. But of course, race relations today, whatever you think about it, are controversial. And so again, the textbooks want to avoid controversy. So unfortunately, the way history gets taught, it doesn't have any relevance to the present.
I was fascinated by the Reconstruction period. It was one of my focuses when I was in college. And one of the things that fascinated me so much was that it was a time not only when black people had, you know, were getting some rights and some power, but also that they were making alliances with poor white farmers. And that
was
precisely the Ku Klux Klan that, you know, said, well, we can't have that. We have to divide and conquer. And that movement was called the populist movement. And now, how are we using the word populist today?
Yeah, isn't that something? That upsets me every time I see the word populist, because populist has come to mean kind of veiled neo-racist. And it wasn't that at all. It was for the people, for all the people. And that's exactly what happened. Between 1890 and 1940, there's this terribly important era, the nadir of race relations, when we become more and more racist as a nation, North and South. We see this in all kinds of ways. And students need to get in on this, and there's ways to have them show it in their own community, even if their community, for instance, has a newspaper. It's easy to analyze the newspaper stories and see how they change between, say, 1880 and 1890 and 1900 as the newspaper gets more racist and the community gets more racist. Well, the one reason for that was the populist movement. That is, in reaction to the populist movement, the white racist Democrats put through what was called the Mississippi Plan. But it wasn't just Mississippi. It's one of the reasons why we date the nadir as starting in 1890. The new constitution for the state of Mississippi, passed in that year, kept black folks from being citizens. It removed them from citizenship, kept them from voting, and so on. And the mechanisms it used, nobody ever judged them unconstitutional, astoundingly enough, even though they went right in the teeth of the 14th and 15th Amendments. So Alabama followed suit. Every other southern state followed suit. Even states as far away as Oklahoma followed suit. And now we have the phenomenon that the United States is allowing a whole bunch of states to openly keep blacks from voting. Well, how are you going to deal with that if you, say, live on Long Island or you live in Western Massachusetts, either one? You're a good person. You don't want to say, well, this is a great country. It's democratic, and I know that the black folks can't be voting anymore and aren't really citizens, and I'm kind of a nerd or kind of a jerk for putting up with that. You don't want to say that. So instead you say, well, I hardly know any black folks. Those Southerners know them a lot better, and that's probably appropriate, and I'm sure they'll get their rights back when they've earned them. And blam, you're saying a bunch of racist stuff yourself, things about them, about the out-group. So this nadir of race relations sweeps across the North, too, and sundown towns sweep across Long Island, and they sweep across almost all of the North, towns that are all white on purpose.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with James Loewen about his newly reissued bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me. And so, you know, right there we can see why not studying the past will lead us to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Well, I don't think it's as simple as that. Just that happy idea, because that happy idea implies that, well, if we just study the past, then we won't repeat the mistakes of the past, and we don't know that. But I think the issue is this. What we can use history for is to learn what causes what. I mean, for example, if we want to know what causes racism, because we think we need more and more of it, well, then we can look at what went on between 1876 and 1891, because that's when the seeds of the nadir of race relations were sown. If we want to know what decreases racism, well, then we can look at what went on from about 1862 to about 1876. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of causation that we need to learn about, and then we will have some idea about how to proceed in the present with regard to whatever the problem is that we're talking about. And that would make us all smarter as a people and better able to vote for people and policies that might work.
Right, and you say that that's something that U.S. high school textbooks really get wrong, that they don't think about causality in history, by and large. First of all, why do you think it's absent? I mean, the not talking about causes seems pretty fundamental to the teaching of history. And then what are the key questions you ask students in order to teach causality?
Well, to the first question, I think it's, again, because it's likely to be controversial. I have to say, a lot of teachers aren't very good at teaching controversy, and I understand that. First of all, I was a teacher, and I can remember, as a college teacher, being contradicted by a student in class who might even be right. That would even be scarier. Or who might be wrong. And that is a tense moment in the classroom, and you have to think about how to handle that. And so we have to make sure that we teach in such a way as to allow students to have academic freedom. But at the same time, we have to say, look, you have a right to your own opinion, but you don't have a right to your own fact. You have to use facts that you can show, then, that we can all agree on. And once you do that, and you show why this, and this is a key question to ask students when they cite a website or when they cite a movie or when they cite, for that matter, a really allegedly good work of history, and that is, why is this source credible? If you just ask them that question, ain't but four words, why is this source credible, five words, then suddenly they have to think, oh, gosh, maybe it isn't. And even if it is, I have to show why it is. And they'd only have to write a sentence. And, of course, I have to say, a KKK site from Harrison, Arkansas, which is one of the leadership places for the KKK, is perfectly credible if the question is, what does the KKK think about X, you know? But if the question is, how do we assess Martin Luther King's impact in the United States, maybe that's not the best site, you know?
Right. I mean, one of the ideas that you also mentioned that textbooks often get wrong is a kind of false equivalency, the idea that you have to have two sides. Okay, we can certainly talk about two sides, but they make an equivalence.
No, we can't sometimes.
Well, exactly. You know, when Trump, for example, said about Charlottesville that there are good people on both sides, he was derided for using false equivalency. And it was interesting because it was the first time that I'd actually heard that term, false equivalency, used in a kind of mainstream way. And you say that that idea of false equivalency is generally not taught. You know, we can think of the climate change, quote unquote, debate.
Yeah, people have to realize that what newspapers and TV stations have have lapsed into this kind of lazy rhetoric in which you call on somebody. I'm going to use the T word right now because I'm going to talk about a government policy. But you know, you call on a Trump person, let's say somebody from a government agency, and then you call on somebody from the Democratic Party or somebody from a non-government organization who's taking the opposite side, let's say maybe the Sierra Club, and then you've covered it. You've had two points of view, and you don't take a side. And one reason you don't take a side today is because there's less and less investigative journalism being done for economic reasons, unfortunately.
Yeah, and another idea is, you know, that kind of postmodernism, postmodern idea that, quote, truth doesn't exist. I mean, interestingly enough, that actually came out of the left originally, but now it seems to be really rampant among the right.
Yep, I strapped that on in Lies My Teacher Told Me. I've been strapping it on for years, but in the new preface, I talk about it overtly and specifically. It bugs the heck out of me. I spent some time at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, and among other things, that place is a graduate school. That is, there's all kinds of graduate students there for postdocs or for pre-doc fellowships of 3 months to 9 months, maybe even 12 months. So I learned from that experience and from visiting some history departments that the in thing to say these days goes something like this. Why should we privilege one narrative above others with the adjective true? And I would reply, when I was really on the ball, I would reply with this little shtick. I would say, right, and the Civil War began in 1876 in Nevada. It grew out of a pay dispute between the Union Pacific Railroad and its Chinese employees. And they would look at me as if I was crazy, which that sentence is, and say, but that's not true. And I would say, bingo. Right. And then I would say, well, now that's maybe too easy, but how about the issue of secession? And we'd go back to that, and I'd point out that it is not arguable. There is a flat bedrock of fact about that. Secession is for the cause of slavery, its extension, and its preservation. So it's not arguable. It is not a matter of you're going to have two opinions. States' rights is one and slavery is another, or maybe tariffs and taxes is a third. No, you are not going to do that. And what you are instead going to do is you're going to point out what's wrong with tariffs and taxes as an argument, what's wrong with states' rights as an argument, and therefore what's wrong with the textbook, because the textbook leaves these things in there. And therefore, students are going to say, huh? We got to think about this textbook. We're not just supposed to learn it. We're supposed to critique it at the same time. And then they're getting some practice at critiquing. Yeah.
Now, this book is a bestseller, has been a bestseller. Why did you reissue it?
Well, the reason I reissued it was, first of all, to get this new preface into it. And the new preface is called something like, Lies My Teacher Told Me in the Age of Alternative Facts. And so it tries to make this book relevant to what we've been really talking about, namely that everything seems up for grabs. We seem to be in this, quote, post-truth era, unquote. And I try to show what's wrong with that and that the problem really begins in how we get mistaught history in school. So that's the key reason why it came out in this new edition. And I have to say, it's been very successful in this new edition. It's selling even better. So I'm thinking that it's reaching a whole lot of general public people, and then it's reaching through them some kids who then bother their teachers. I've gotten these wonderful emails, and maybe I'll close with the very best one, which said this. I memorized it. Dear Mr. Lowen, I really enjoy your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I've been using it to heckle my teacher from the back of the room.
That's great. Well, James Lowen, Jim Lowen, you are the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me and a whole host of other books in the same vein. I want to thank you very much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
My pleasure to be with you.
James E. Lowen. In addition to Lies My Teacher Told Me, he's the author of Sundown Towns and Mississippi Conflict and Change, among other books. You can read an excerpt from Lies My Teacher Told Me by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the great Lois Lowry. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Lois Lowry's many books for children are famous for tackling difficult issues like racism, the Holocaust, and, most famously in her classic, The Giver, The Dangers of Conformity. Now, one of America's greatest novelists of children's literature is writing a play about another difficult subject, gun violence in our schools. She was already working on it when the Parkland shooting happened, but that event made the urgency of her work even more palpable. Her new play takes place inside a high school classroom. The identity of the shooter is unknown until the end. That's because the play explores the many serious pressures that young people today are subject to. All the students in the class have some burden to bear, any one of which could drive them to crack. The play, currently titled Fun and Games, is a work in progress. It's been workshopped in several venues, including New York City at NYU. It was commissioned by the Oregon Children's Theater and will be performed in its final form there in October. Well, Lois Lowry, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you.
So this play, it's called Fun and Games. I understand it's called Fun and Games for now. It's very much a play in progress. First of all, just tell us a little bit about the play itself. What is a central theme?
Well, I'm not even certain it's far enough along to be able to state a central theme, but it started out with the idea of writing a play dealing with the problem of gun violence, specifically in schools. And that originated way back last September. Once the theater director who was commissioning the play and I agreed on that as a topic, then as the months passed, every day there was a new bit of news, a new school shooting, and so things shifted and changed, and they probably still are, sadly. However, that was the starting point, and that will still be the ending point, and I'm still in the process of going from A to Z, start to end.
So is this a play, when you say that it's in progress, you're working on it, but you're presenting it at the same time. Is it going to be at some point a more formalized, fixed play, or is the idea that it is always going to be a play in progress?
No, my intention and the theater director's is that it will be a finished play at some point and then will be formally performed. But at the moment, it's being created, and it has been workshopped at NYU, which means that the existing script at that time, and this was this past June, was cast and performed with everybody realizing it was very much in progress. So after that week of workshop and people commented, audience came and left comments, and the theater director and the dramaturge and I all talked and revised. And then it ended up back on my desk where it now is, and I'm rewriting. And the next destination for it will be a workshop in Oregon, and that time is yet to be determined, perhaps sometime this winter. Following that, it will be fixed in stone, I guess would be a good phrase. Following that second workshop, it will be complete. It will be revised again, and that will be the final revision. And at that point, presumably, if everything goes well, at that point it will be performed in Oregon at the theater which commissioned it. And following that, it would then be available to other theaters.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I mean, just purely as, you know, a writing process, is this a normal procedure for plays, or is this...
Yeah, I think it is. A play... Let me back up a minute and say this. I'm normally a writer of fiction, of novels, and that's something that the writer does alone and finishes alone, and then with an editor's help does some revisions. But it's a one-person process. A play is an entirely different thing because it involves a lot of collaboration. And so this is already in the stage of collaboration with the director, but at some point down the line, there will also be collaboration with set designers and perhaps choreographers and scenery and costumes and all of that. So it's no longer a one-person enterprise. That's very exhilarating for me because I'm accustomed to sitting alone in a room and having everything weighing on my shoulders, and to work in concert with other very gifted people is a departure and a very exhilarating one. But it's also, as you perceive from my description of the timeline, it's also a very time-consuming process. You know, right now it's here on my desk being revised, and then it will go back to the theater director, and more things will happen after that. And in the meantime, time passes, the calendar pages flip by, and so it's not a quick job. It's a lengthy process, and I think that probably serves it well, because all of the time in between things is time when the brain is working.
Yeah, so you're really processing it both consciously and unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's important.
Now, this is a play that is for young people, and young people make up a bulk of the characters in it. Do the young actors also have a voice in this collaborative process?
When it was workshopped in New York, it was cast down there by the theater department, and the actors were young, well, they were graduate students, some of them, and some of them were already working actors. Of course, they were all young because they were playing the role of teenagers. I think ultimately the goal is to have it available for actual high school age performers, to be performing it for a high school age audience. It would not be for a younger audience. I think it would be, you know, ninth grade and up. And the performers would be appropriate age.
And that's because it goes into some very difficult and uncomfortable topics. Mm-hmm. Now tell us a little bit about the play itself that, you know, you're calling right now Fun and Games.
In the beginning, when it was first written and workshopped in New York, it was very much in flux. And what remains is the fact that it grapples with the question of gun violence and who might be the person who will ultimately, down the road, not on the stage, pick up a gun and aim it at innocent people. And so it presents a cast of young people, any one of whom might be that person. And the audience then becomes a kind of participant, because the audience has to guess from the information given who that will be. Now, in the original workshop, and I don't know if this will be retained till the final version, but in the original, the cast itself also did not know. It was a completely random selection, and so each day of each performance, it could be a different actor who is the one who picks up the gun. And that, to me, as a writer, was very challenging and exciting. The thought that nobody would know, even I wouldn't know, because we had a mechanism by which that person would emerge by the end of the play as the one. I don't know if we'll retain that. I like the idea of it, but it became, when we workshopped it, it became evident that it was difficult to make clear to the audience that it was a random selection. They assumed, seeing it only one time, they assumed that the actor who stood there with the gun at the end was going to be the actor the next night and the next night. And there was no way really to let them know that it had been a random choice. So that's kind of one of my tasks now. But, I got sidetracked and I didn't really answer your question fully. But what it's dealing with, I mean, the broadest concept is the theme of gun violence. But I think what it grapples with or tries to is whether it is predictable who among us will become that person. And if it's predictable, is it therefore preventable? And those are almost unanswerable questions. So that's what's making it tough on me as the playwright, dealing with questions that perhaps have no answers. And maybe the best I can hope for is to present the questions, so to give an audience something to ponder and think about.
Well, that's so interesting. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lois Lowry, best-selling author of The Giver and other books for young adults, about a play she's working on. Its current title is Fun and Games, and it's about a school shooting. Now, you grew up in a military family. You married somebody who was in the military. I'm curious, did that experience, that background of yours, have an impact on the way you view violence in society in general, and also maybe how you approach this play?
Well, interesting question, and I'm not sure I can answer it. My father was a career military officer, that's true, and so I grew up as a child on Army bases. But my father was not a guy with a gun. My father was a dental surgeon. And so during World War II, he was on a hospital ship treating facial and jaw injuries. So he didn't, I don't think, have the kind of mindset that General Patton would have. And then it's true, I did marry a guy who was briefly in the Navy, but that was just a way of paying back his obligation for his college tuition. And he served only a few years and then went to law school. I will add also that I had a son who, when he grew up, joined the military. He finished college, and he was an adventurer and an athlete, and he became a fighter pilot in the Air Force. That took me by surprise. It was something that he did well and that he loved doing, and sadly, it was what killed him. He was killed in the military, and so I had to stand at a gravesite and watch the Air Force fly a missing man formation overhead. So I have not even mixed feelings about the military. I am aware of the need for a military, and I'm glad that there were people like my son who were willing to serve in the military. But I'm not a militaristic person, and I don't think it really informed this play, which is more, I'm not attempting a political statement in the play, but I certainly am somebody myself who is in favor of much stricter gun laws. And if I were going to make or try to make a political statement, which is not appropriate, I don't think, it would be more on a side of a pacifist than a militarist.
And you've written about 45 books, Lois Lowry. You won 2 Newbery Medals, one for one of my favorite books, The Giver. And you've said that all your books deal essentially with the same general theme, the importance of human connections. Is that not something that becomes political, not in a bad way, but maybe in a good way in this world? I guess
anything really is political if you use the broadest possible definition. I'm working on a book right now that deals with my own background and the fact that I was a child born in Honolulu, a child playing on a beach when in the background, as I can see in home movies now from that era, the Arizona was sailing past. And the Arizona was a ship that carried 1,100 young men who all died at Pearl Harbor. And then many years later, I lived in Japan after the atomic bomb had been dropped there. So that's been part of my existence that I think has influenced my strong feeling that we, as the globe becomes smaller by means of communication and transportation, we are all connected to each other. My son, incidentally, the one who was the Air Force pilot, had, when he was stationed in Germany, married a German woman, lovely young woman, who's my daughter-in-law still, though she's now his widow. And at his wedding, I sat there in a church in Germany with her parents, who were my age, and her mother had been a child hiding in a basement in a German village when the American troops marched in. She said, hiding there terrified because they were so afraid of the monsters that they thought the Americans would be. And instead, when an American soldier opened the door of that basement and found her there crying, he reached into his pocket and gave her candy, which I think is just a statement of the futility of war and the fact that we are all human beings, and as you just pointed out, I have once said, connected to each other in complex ways. How I move from that general feeling into this play, I can't quite articulate at this point because I'm not far enough along in the process.
And yet the question that you ask, I think, is very salient to this. The puzzlement, how can somebody, what drives someone? What is the rhyme or reason of someone shooting up a school?
Yeah. And why does it happen here and it doesn't happen in Finland, for example? I mean, these are all questions to be raised. And I'm afraid that they don't at this point have any real answers, but I think it's important to ask them. And for me as a writer, to ask them, for people who are readers or audiences in a theater, to ask them of themselves and of the people whom they're with. I just wish there were easy answers for them, but of course there aren't.
And so what did you think when Parkland happened? You were already in the midst of this.
I was in the midst of this. You know, I felt this terrible shudder when I heard the news. I spent part of the winter in Florida, though, on the West Coast. And that's where I was when I heard of that happening, and was already in the midst of thinking about these things. And oddly, this is just another little footnote, in the play, and this will still be true by the end of the writing, the characters, who are high school students, are both male and female. And they're of different ethnicities. That would be determined by casting whoever, you know, whatever theater was in. But they are both male and female. And along the way, I found myself thinking, well, would an audience believe that a female, that a girl could become the one who picks up the gun? And as I was pondering that, suddenly in the news, there was a shooting. This one was in California. It wasn't in a school. It was in a company, I've forgotten which company, in Northern California. And the shooter that time was female. And although it didn't make me breathe a sigh of relief, it did tell me, uh-oh, yeah, it could be. It could be either one.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Lois Lowry, best-selling author of The Giver, about her play in progress about a school shooting. It's tentatively titled Fun and Games. Now, the version that I saw, and I only saw Act 1, does not give names to the individual students. They're just called by who, you know.
Yeah, they're called by descriptive phrases, but the reason for that is that my assumption is, my hope is, that they would be cast in different ethnicities And so if I called a girl character Betsy, and then she was cast by, and the casting put an actress in that role who is Asian or Muslim, the name would be inappropriate. So my guess is that it will end up with the general descriptive phrase, which I'm currently using, but that individual theater directors can give names to the characters once they're cast, and give them names that would be appropriate to their ethnicity.
Because it was almost Brechtian to me to have them as descriptive names. But even the dialogue was, you know, reminded me of Mother Courage in a way.
You know, the first version of this, which is not what you're seeing, fell into the category of theater of the absurd. And I'm trying to back away from that because the audience at the first workshop didn't understand that. And maybe I'd made it too absurd. And the character who is now designated simply the teacher, at that point he shifted characters and he became a ringmaster with a whip, and he spoke to the audience frequently in asides. And it was too bizarre for the audience that saw it. I kind of liked it, but I've got to bow to whatever's out there and what their needs are. So I'm not sure how it will end up, but yeah, I like your description of Brechtian, and it will not be a conventional play. Obviously, it doesn't deal with conventional material.
Now, in The Giver, and that, you don't call it a trilogy, you call it a...
It's a quartet now, actually.
A quartet.
There are four books.
That's right. You write about a society which tries to protect its children from any knowledge of conflict, pain, or sorrow. In this, it's quite the opposite. These kids...
It's all right out there. Yeah.
Exactly. Talk a little bit about your sense of what it feels like to you to convey the vulnerability of children growing up in a society like this. In a way, it's the same issue, but taken from the opposite side.
It's in the reverse, yeah. I think the community of The Giver, though I didn't realize it when I was writing that book, probably drew a great deal on my growing up on army posts, because that's a very circumscribed community, often with a wall of some sort around it, and with strict rules. I can remember, I started to name one place, but it was true in a number of places. At 5 o'clock every evening, over a loudspeaker, they would play whatever the bugle call is. It has a name, and retreat, it's called, is a particular bugle melody, and they lower the flag. And when that happens, 5 o'clock in the evening, if you're on that army base, you stand at attention with your hand over your heart. I can see in my mind still my little brother dropping his bicycle down to the ground. He would have been maybe 8 years old, and standing there very solemnly with his hand over his heart. And it was just the kind of ritualized behavior that made us all, as children at least, feel very safe in those circumstances. Within those walls where everything was so organized and comfortable. And so that meant, too, that every time I moved from one place to another, there was not the terrible dislocation that a child in civilian circumstances might feel moving from one city to another, because I would move to yet one other army base, and the rules would be the same. So all of that, and now I've forgotten what your original question was, but yes, that's in the book, The Giver, that's the kind of life the boy leads, and the community has created that kind of life in order to protect children or all of their citizens, to make them feel very comfortable and safe. In doing that, of course, you realize by the end, they've made terrible sacrifices, and they've lost a great deal. So now, moving forward to this current, one of the things I'm working on, this current play, This is a piece of writing portraying a community, in this case a school, where everything is not safe. And it's right out there. Not only the possibility of an armed person coming into the school and killing people, which is out there now in every school, but also as you get to know the kids who are the actors, each of them has their vulnerabilities in the play. They're referred to as secrets, and of course that's something that we all have. So the question is, what's appropriate for young people in particular to read about in a book written by me, to see in a play written by me or someone else? And I was recently asked this question. I was in Los Angeles. I was speaking at a conference, and the question was raised. There were only 1,000 people, and the question was raised in front of the audience. Is there something that should not be written about for kids, something we should protect them from? I hadn't known the question would be asked, so perhaps my answer was given without time for a great deal of thought. But I did say, and I do believe, that there's nothing kids should not know about, but it should be presented to them, depending on their age and according to their age, with intelligence and sensitivity. And I guess, even though that was a hasty answer to a question given to me this weekend, I guess I would still stick by that. I don't think there's anything that kids should be protected from knowledge of. Certainly there are things they should be protected from, but they need to be aware of what's out there. This world is a very frightening place. And I guess it's our role to, you know, try to keep them safe as best we can, and I think with education and with knowledge does come a bit of safety.
It puts me in mind of, you know, we live in a society where people are so protective that kids are not even allowed to spend a minute outside by themselves. Even.
Oh, I know.
And yet it's a society where they go to school and they can get shot up.
Yeah, there are such terrible ironies there. I remember, I'm 81 years old, and I remember the days of my childhood when I would get on my bike in the morning and my mother wouldn't see me until supper time. I lived in a small town at that point during World War II. When my father was gone, we went back to the town where our grandparents lived. And I'd like to say it was a safe place. And yet, on the outskirts of that town, there is a little marker, a memorial, where at some time prior to my birth, but not that long prior, the bodies of 3 little girls had been found. And I grew up knowing that had happened outside that town. So there's really no place where we're exempt. But I do remember with a feeling of great nostalgia those days when I would be out there alone on my bike, just roaming my world.
Well, Lois Lowry, your newest work in progress is a play which is currently being called Fun and Games. It has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this, such a privilege. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it, too.
Lois Lowry is a celebrated author of many works for children, including The Giver Quartet, Number of the Stars, and the Goonie Bird series. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.